And then they're lied into the next war, right? It guarantees that these crimes will continue.
All right. And David, and what about the other side of that spectrum? What message does it give other countries, those that are not under the influence of the hegemonic power? Your perspective, because we said with the U.S. not being held responsible, and what about the other side of the spectrum? For example, countries of the resistance.
For countries of the resistance, which have the capacity to defend themselves, I believe that this is just further evidence of the need to continue to build up their defensive capacities and to organize. But unfortunately, for countries that have less of a defensive capacity, and I'm thinking about countries such as Venezuela, this could likely have a very chilling effect, because the United States, as we have seen regarding Venezuela, for example, over the last year, continues to engage in attempted coup attempts and regime change, even assassinations by drone, of course, with the sanctions, the labeling of the political elites as not only terrorists, but also, drug runners. And so the United States still, unfortunately, maintains the capacity to shape its own narrative and to put that narrative forward for the American people. Again, getting back to the issue of self-reliance and defense, it's just critically important that nations of the resistance maintain their ability to produce their own technology and to defend their sovereignty and their people.
All right. Well, David Yakubian, Dan Kovale, thank you both for being with us. I appreciate both of you being with us. And always, we appreciate you being with us on another program. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the concept of martyrdom. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Some people think that the highest worth is the worth of this material life, while there are a lot of things more valuable than it. There are some moments in life in which man wishes for death, and there are truths for which he sacrifices himself without hesitation. The martyrs, for example, who lay down their lives for the sake of their religion and justice and other virtues, are those who understand the deep truth in this reality. When they found life pleasant and death a window to a wider world, as well as God's satisfaction, they bade farewell to life and embraced death for a higher purpose. The 11th infallible Imam has said, "Better than this life is that which, if you lose it, you would hate life, and worse than death is that which, if it happens to you, you would welcome death." See how profound that statement is. Imam alayhi salam is pointing to a fact that there are things more worthier than this life of this world. And, you know, when it comes to value and being something being precious, there are other elements and there are other formulas that play into the picture. We see that there are sacrifices given by parents, for example, for their kids. If parents are given this option that it's either your life or your child's, you know that most parents would save their child. These are very small manifestations of what we are trying to convey here. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about the value of life, the value of death, and how there are things that are precious to a human being than his own life. The concept of martyrdom is one of the manifestations of that very reality. The concept of martyrdom or shahada in Islam can only be understood in the light of the Islamic concept of holy struggle, jihad. And the concept of jihad may only be appreciated if the concept of the doctrine of enjoining right and discovering wrong, Amr bil Ma'ruf, Nahi anil Munkar, is properly appreciated. And good and bad, right and wrong, can only be understood if the independent divine sources of righteousness, truth, and goodness, and how the message of the divine source of righteousness and truth has been honestly and properly conveyed to humanity through prophethood, are understood. So see how it is a comprehensive package. You cannot have martyrdom without the real understanding of what jihad means. And we will explain in future episodes how jihad is misinterpreted not only by non-Muslims, but in some cases, some Muslims as well. But without jihad, there's no martyrdom. And for us to be able to do jihad, we have to have that proper understanding of the reasons behind why we struggle in the way of Allah. So it is all connected to each other. Looking at it in isolation will only confuse you. When you look at the concept, a profound concept like martyrdom, you have to think deeper than the surface level analysis. dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The crisis in Yemen is deepening as fresh fierce clashes between Yemeni forces and Saudi-led militants have erupted in Ma'arib. The clashes happened between Yemeni forces and Allied Popular Committees fighters and the rival forces who are loyal to former President Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. Local sources say the Yemeni troops and Allied Popular Committee fighters mounted intensive attacks from the north, south, and west to push the Saudi mercenaries out of the region. Saudi warplanes are reported to have conducted more than a dozen strikes on residential areas across the region.
Well, it clearly shows that the Ansarullah movement cannot be defeated. And that's what's so important, that Saudi Arabia, with all of its vast military equipment and years of U.S. support, military aid, jet aircraft, naval blockades, have failed to defeat the Ansarullah movement. And as a matter of fact, have suffered one defeat after another.
Over the past few weeks, Ma'arib has been the scene of large-scale operations by Yemeni troops and their allied forces. They are pushing against Saudi-sponsored pro-Hadi militants. Yemeni forces are closing in on Ma'arib, the last stronghold of pro-Hadi forces in northern Yemen. The loss of the strategic region would mean the defeat of the Saudi-backed regime. Yemeni forces had earlier liberated several strategic heights in the northwest of the province after intense fighting. Analysts believe control of the oil-rich region of Ma'arib would strengthen the bargaining position of Yemeni forces and peace talks. The fierce clashes come amid fresh attempts to bring an end to what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Analysts believe Saudi Arabia is desperate to find a face-saving way out of its disastrous bombing campaign in Yemen. It is believed that the Saudi regime has failed miserably in Yemen, as its foreign interventions have failed to produce desirable results for the kingdom.
Clearly, it shows that Saudi Arabia could not prevail through military measures. So now they are talking about, let's have a peace agreement. But they're asking for many things that they could not win on the battlefield. So whether they will gain it in peace talks, that's highly unlikely.
The new administration in Washington has pushed for fresh attempts to bring the war to an end. But Yemeni forces have dismissed the so-called peace initiatives presented by the U.S. to end the war in the country, saying such plans are not favorable since they fail to include the Yemeni nation's demands, including lifting the siege on the port city of Aden.
The UN is acting in favor of major powers and exhibits clear bias. The aggressor countries are committing the most heinous crimes against Yemeni children, and yet they were not included in the list. The UN decision is disconnected from realities and does not rely on independent accounts.
Any peace agreement must be based on ending the siege, the closing of the ports, and the distribution of food to the population of Yemen, who've been held hostage by Saudi Arabia and also by the U.S. through this whole process.
Ansarullah movement says no just solution to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been worked out yet. The Yemenis say the aggressors have to end all their attacks against Yemen, take out all their forces, end an all-out siege that they have been imposing on the Arab country, including the port city of Aden, and compensate the victims before entering any peace process.
Well, they certainly have no desirable result. They first announced that this would be a war over in a matter of weeks and then months, and it has dragged on for more than 6 years. So it's a complete disaster in the eyes of the entire region. It does show the weakness of this corrupt regime that is unable to carry on a war against a country far less technologically, doesn't have the means, doesn't have the military forces, and yet it has a mobilization of the people. And that is what is decisive again and again, as we're finding in every country.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies have been engaged in a devastating war in the country that began in March 2015. They were backed by the U.S. and other Western powers. The aggressors were trying to reinstall Yemen's former president, Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, a staunch ally of Riyadh, to crush the Ansarullah movement. The Saudi war has failed to achieve its goals, but pushed Yemen to the brink of a humanitarian crisis. Saudi officials claimed that the war would last only a few weeks.
These are the last German soldiers to withdraw from Afghanistan. Over the last couple of years, Germany had the second largest contingent of troops after the United States. The German defense minister says that after nearly 20 years of deployment, the last soldiers left Afghanistan. Annegret Kramp-Karren Bauer added that this is the end of a historic chapter of an intensive mission. 59 German soldiers died in Afghanistan, 35 of them had been killed in combat or as a result of militant attack, making it Germany's deadliest military mission since World War II. Looking back, the minister vowed to discuss where it went wrong and what Berlin has learned.
We've not only accomplished nothing, we have grievously damaged Afghan society over the last 20 years of bombing and so on and so forth. There was never a political coalition in Afghanistan to support the United States, even less so than in Vietnam, in my opinion.
Because of the security problems in Afghanistan and the increasing levels of violence, the German military kept the details of its withdrawal vague. Berlin sent its forces in the wake of the 9/11 attacks on the US in 2001. Meanwhile, British media reports suggest the majority of British troops have quietly withdrawn from Afghanistan. Again, Britain withdrawing its forces, if confirmed, would have been shrouded in secrecy. According to the latest UN report, US-led forces, in particular Germany and Italy and the UK, are leaving Afghanistan while the country remains in bad shape. Violence is on the rise and Afghans are facing multiple crises, including rising poverty, which could increase from 50% to 70%. These all suggest that over two decades of foreign military presence has failed to bring peace to Afghanistan. In mid-April, US President Joe Biden and NATO announced they would pull out the roughly 10,000 foreign troops still in Afghanistan at the time by September 11, marking the 20th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York that sparked the invasion of the country itself. The mission had been aimed at toppling the then-ruling Taliban government. 20 years later, Washington has been negotiating with the militant group itself on the best way to withdraw. During those 20 years, Afghans have witnessed a spiral of violence and terror.
It's obvious that this 20 years here hasn't benefited the Afghans in any way. Here we are with 2,500 troops left, more or less, who knows, thousands of contractors, and several different things have come out in the newspaper in the last week. One, in spite of all this alleged training and so on and so forth, the only thing that is flyable in Afghanistan right now over the next few weeks are the Russian-made helicopters.
Meanwhile, U.S. officials speaking to CNN on condition of anonymity indicated that America itself may complete its withdrawal within days. One official says the Pentagon is considering keeping at least 650 troops in the country to safeguard the American embassy and Kabul airport. This comes as violence has sharply increased between Taliban militants and government forces since the U.S. missed a May withdrawal deadline agreed between the militants group and the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump. According to the Pentagon, the Taliban are now estimated to be in control control of 81 districts out of the country's 419. There are fears of a looming civil war as the warring sides struggle to clinch a possible power-sharing peace deal during intra-Afghan negotiations.
The United States says it carried out deadly airstrikes on the positions of Iraq Popular Mobilization units on both sides of the border with Syria on Sunday. Washington claimed their strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The attack drew angry reactions from Iraq and Syria. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Syria, for its part, also condemned in strongest terms the U.S. flagrant oppression in the Syrian-Iraqi border region, describing it as a blatant violation of the sanctity of the Syrian and Iraqi territories.
We have to understand instability is the goal. This is when a war cannot necessarily be won, the invader, the attacker, the aggressor can sort of make the next best thing in their interest, and that is for the war to be constant, the war to be permanent, never ending, the chaos to rule supreme, the strategy of chaos, which is that you destabilize a region to such an extent that they will have no choice but to accept your continued presence. This is something that we've seen in Afghanistan as well. How many times has NATO decided and said and promised that they were going to pull back? Now it looks like the Americans are finally going to pull back, but it is really a wait-and-see sort of thing.
Syria says the latest U.S. attack once again showed the recklessness of Washington's policies and the need for Washington to withdraw its aggressor forces from the region. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. But the U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order.
Again, fortunately, this sort of psychological operation hasn't exactly succeeded, because despite everything, the Iraqis definitely, and the Syrians as well, they still don't want U.S. boots on the ground. They want all Americans out. Doesn't matter what the alternative is. They don't want these imperialist invaders to keep occupying their land. But this is what the Americans keep on trying, and this is exactly why they make up these stupid excuses with which to attack and destroy not the terrorists but the people who fight against the terrorists, because they try to make it almost in an Orwellian way. They try to switch around the definitions and blame the people who are defending their country for terrorism, while they start to portray the terrorists as quote-unquote freedom fighters, or, you know, people who are moderate rebels fight for democracy like they did in Syria.
The PMU was formed by popular volunteer forces in 2014 after the Daesh terror group launched a campaign of bloodshed and destruction against Iraq. The group played a major role in pushing back and ultimately defeating the terrorist forces, which had taken control of large swathes of the Arab country. Apart from the United States, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
Inhumane sanctions imposed on Iran by the West and the U.S. have hampered the country's efforts to purchase vaccines. The sanctions not only targeted the Iranian oil and banking sector, but also hit pharmaceutical companies and are in violation of the U.N. Charter. Meanwhile, the United States has recently issued a guide to pave the way for the delivery of masks, respirators, and vaccines to countries subject to severe sanctions, such as Iran. That's 16 months after the beginning of the pandemic, when the Islamic Republic has made its vaccine and over 82,000 Iranians have died from the coronavirus. The Islamic Republic has managed to join the few countries around the world developing vaccines to fight the coronavirus disease by producing its first domestic COVID-19 vaccine, known as Coviran Barakat. Iran will focus on using three locally made COVID-19 vaccines, including Russia's Sputnik V and a vaccine jointly produced with Cuba named Pastor-Covac vaccine. Iran has also launched a clinical trial of yet another vaccine, dubbed Nura, as part of its drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. Iran is also participating in the COVAX scheme. That's why the United Nations had previously slammed the group of seven wealthy nations for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19. For months, the United States, Britain, and Canada practiced vaccine hoarding, even as poorer nations elsewhere had yet to even distribute doses to their medical workers on the front lines of the pandemic. The U.S., its European allies, and their sanctions regime have targeted ordinary Iranian citizens who are facing one of the worst global health crises. Meanwhile, Iran has managed to develop local vaccines amid cruel sanctions and is prepared to mass-produce jabs to provide the world.
Firstly, it says that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a moral medical obligation. It's actually not necessarily trying to profiteer from this vaccine, as with the Pfizer and other vaccines, which are charging very high rates even here. They're making money out of it. It's basically big business. The Islamic Republic of Iran, clearly at something like $8 a shot, isn't profiteering. And I think that, in a way, is one thing which is very positive. The other thing it says about Iran is that it has an ability to do things itself. This advancement in medical fields, in technological fields, scientific fields, bodes very well for Iran's future. It's not relying on the West.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, received his first dose of the Coviran Barakat vaccine on Friday. Coviran Barakat vaccine was approved for emergency mass application by the country's health ministry earlier this month. Before receiving his first dose of the Coviran Barakat vaccine, the leader had set two prior conditions. First, insisting not to receive the vaccine outside the schedule that had been devised for the rest of the Iranians, and second, required to receive only Iranian vaccines. After receiving the jab, the leader thanked all those who were involved in the development of the homegrown vaccine. He said there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he noted that he did not want to use a non-Iranian vaccine. That marked the leader's trust in Iranian scientists and his support for domestic production.
I think the first thing it says is that Ayatollah Khamenei himself is demonstrating his approval of this vaccine, and he's showing that he's leading by example in order to instill confidence, one would assume, within the populace as a whole. On the other hand, he's also making it very clear that this vaccine is one that he's accepted because it's produced by the Islamic Republic of Iran, independent of all others.
Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and it started to be mass-produced on March 29. That placed Iran among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. Under the hardest sanctions, Iran managed to produce its homegrown vaccine. Once again, Iranian scientists proved that nothing is impossible for the Iranian nation, as their will is strong enough to overcome any hardships, including sanctions. Allah, Allah,
Allah, Allah, Allah. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance. Spring of Truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirrussalat, The Secret of Prayer by Imam Khomeini. And the learned ones, he said, I worship him because I love him. And to the holy men is to decide to obey naturally after the vision of the beloved, independently and essentially and annihilated in lordship, essentially and attributably and actually. And due to the utterance of Imam Sadiq, I worship Allah for his love. Perhaps it is his ordinary stage, as our perfect Shaykh used to say. Such worshipping is merely their special ways, and in some cases, as there are some traditions of the messenger who said, I have some special relation that neither angels nor any messenger have had the same or have such capacity. And there is tradition of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. One day he was performing prayer. He fell and became unconscious. He was asked the reason. He replied, I repeated that verse so many times when I heard it myself. The great Sheikh Shahabuddin said the tongue of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq at that time was like Moses' tree, that through which Allah's words was heard.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi. Imam Khomeini talks about a wrong selection, or if a person who does not care about the Islamic rules or laws. Imam Khomeini says, the day perversion is witnessed in the majlis, which is the parliament, when perversions of power seeking and greed are observed in the president or the ministers, know that day marks our impending defeat. Perversions must be checked right then and there. This revolution, which was brought by the martyrs,
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
Those innocent people, those pure and noble people who fought for Islam, who gave their lives for Islam, who struggled for Islam, and they bear the 8-year war, which was with the rest of the world, the enemies, they want to bring some people who are inclined towards West, so that this Islamic revolution must be defeated. Therefore, we need to be very much careful when we are giving vote, when we are trying to elect a person, the person must be noble. The person must be inclined towards Islam. He must be submissive to the Islamic law by himself.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Birds that travel long distances can disperse seeds far and wide. An assessment of the timing and direction of the European bird migration reveals how these patterns might affect seed dispersal as the planet warms, says Barnabas H. Deru, researcher, in an article published under the heading Migratory Birds Aid Redistribution of Plants to New Climates. Stay tuned for more. The rapid pace of global warming and its effects on the habitats raise the question of whether species are able to keep up so that they remain in suitable living conditions. Some animals can move fast to adjust to a swiftly changing climate. Plants, being less mobile, rely on means such as seed dispersal by animals, wind or water, to move to new areas. But this redistribution typically occurs within 1 kilometer of the original plant. Writing in Nature, Gonzalez Varro et al. Shed light on the potential capacity of migratory birds to aid seed dispersal. When the climate in a plant's usual range becomes hotter than it can tolerate, it must colonize new cooler areas that might lie many kilometers away. It is not fully clear how plants distribute their seeds across great distances, let alone how they cross geographical barriers. One explanation for long-distance seed dispersal is through transport by migratory birds. Such birds ingest viable seeds when eating fruit and can move them tens or hundreds of kilometers outside the range of a plant species. In this mode of dispersal, the seeds pass through the bird's digestive tract unharmed and are deposited in feces, which provides fertilizer that aids plant growth. In the case of European migratory birds, for example, the direction of seed dispersal will depend on whether the timing of fruit production coincides with the bird's southward trip to warmer regions around the equator or northward to cooler regions. Many aspects of this process have been a mystery until now. Gonzalez Varro and colleagues report how plants might be able to keep pace with rapid climate change through the help of migrating birds. The authors analyze the fruiting times of plants, patterns of bird migration, and the interactions between fruit-eating birds and fleshy-fruited plants across Europe. Plants with fleshy fruits were chosen for this study because most of their seed transport is by migratory birds, and because fleshy-fruited plants are an important component of the woody plant community in Europe. The common approach until now has been to predict plant dispersal and colonization using models fitted to abiotic factors, such as the current climate. Gonzalez Varro et al. Instead analyzed an impressive data set of 949 different seed dispersal interactions between bird and plant communities, together with data on entire fruiting times and migratory patterns of birds across Europe. The researchers also analyzed DNA traces from bird feces to identify the plants and birds responsible for the seed dispersal. The authors hypothesized that the direction of seed migration depends on how the plants interact with migratory birds, the frequency of these interactions, or the number of bird species that might transport seeds from each plant species. Gonzalez, Varro, and colleagues found that 86% of plant species studied might have seeds dispersed by birds during their southward trip towards drier and hotter equatorial regions in autumn, whereas only about one-third of the plant species might be dispersed by birds migrating north in spring. This dispersal trend was more pronounced in temperate plants than in Mediterranean plant communities examined. These results are in general agreement with well-known patterns of fruiting times and bird migrations. For example, the fruit of most fleshy-fruited plants in Europe ripens at a time that coincides with when birds migrate south towards the equator. Perhaps the most striking feature of these inferred seed movements is the observation that 35% of plant species across European communities, which are closely related on the revolutionary tree, might benefit from long-distance dispersal by the northward journey of migratory birds. This particular subset of plants tends to be fruit over a long period of time, or has fruits that persist over the winter. This means that the ability of plants to keep up with climate change could be shaped by their evolutionary history, implying that future plant communities in northern hemisphere will probably come from plant species that are closely related and that have migrated from the south. Or, to put it another way, the overwhelming majority of plant species that are dispersed south toward drier and hotter regions at the equator will probably be less able to keep pace with rapid climate change in their new locations than will the few winners that are instead dispersed north to cooler climates. to determine which birds might be responsible for the plant redistributions to cooler climates in the north. The authors categorize European bird migrants into Paleoarctic, those that fly to southern Europe and northern Africa during their non-breeding season, and Afro-Paleoarctic, those that winter in sub-Saharan Africa. Only a few common Paleoarctic migrants, such as the black cap, or Sylvia antricapilla, or blackbird Turdus merula, provide most of this crucial dispersal service northwards to cooler regions across Europe. Because migratory birds are able to relocate a small, non-random subset of plants, this could well have a strong influence on the types of plant community that will form under climate change conditions. A major problem, however, is that the role of these birds is dispersing seeds over long distances is already at risk from human pressures and environmental changes. Understanding these large-scale seed dispersal interaction offers a way for targeted conservation actions to protect the areas that are most vulnerable to climate change. And this could include boosting protection efforts in and around the wintering grounds of migratory birds, locations that are already experiencing a rise in human pressures such as illegal bird hunting. Gonzalez, Varro and colleagues' focus on seed dispersal across a northern hemisphere region means that, as with most ecological analysis, the results are dependent on scale, which can cause issues when interpreting data. Because the northern hemisphere has more land area and steeper seasonal temperature gradients than the southern hemisphere does, seed dispersal interactions might have different patterns from those occurring in southern hemisphere or in aquatic systems. For example, seed-eating birds from the genus Squally migrate from southern hemisphere to spend the dry season in equatorial West Africa, then move southwards again when the rains arrive. Their arrival in southern Africa usually coincides with the end of the wet season in this region, when annual grass seeds are in abundance. It will be worth investigating whether migratory birds in the southern hemisphere also influence the redistribution of plant communities during global warming. Likewise, exploring the long-distance dispersal of seeds of aquatic plants, such as seagrasses, by waterbirds is another area for future research that might benefit from Gonzalez, Varro and colleagues' methods. This study provides a great example of how migratory birds might assist plant redistribution to new locations that would normally be difficult for them to reach on their own and which might offer a suitable climate. As the planet warms, understanding how such biological mechanisms reorganize plant communities complements the information available from climate projection models, which offer predictions of future species distributions.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's new episode of The Lantern. One of the things I really find funny, one of the most comical and hilarious misconceptions that exists regarding Islam is that it advocates violence and it teaches people to resort to things that are methods and manners, behaviorisms that are considered less than civil and courteous. I find that ironic and funny and comedic for a whole lot of reasons. But first, let's listen to a short story regarding the benefits, the individual and collective benefits of not resorting to violence, and how in many, many cases it has changed the course of history. And we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends of this program, Lantern. So welcome. We have an interesting story for today, so let's see what's the title. Of course, it's a story about the famous Gandhi. I once hear Gandhi's grandson, Arun Gandhi, share this penetrating insight about his grandfather, all in attendance at his speech were both humbled and electrified. Ironically, if it hadn't been for racism and prejudice, we may not have had a Gandhi. He may have been just another successful lawyer who had made a lot of money. But because of prejudice in South Africa, he was subjected to humiliation within a week of his arrival. He was thrown off a train because of the color of his skin, and it humiliated him so much that he sat on the platform of the station all night, wondering what he could do to gain justice. His first response was one of anger. He was so angry that he wanted eye for eye justice. He wanted to respond violently to the people who humiliated him, but he stopped himself and said, "That's not right." It was not going to get him justice. It might have made him feel good for the moment, but it wasn't going to get him any justice. The second response was to want to go back to India and live among his own people in dignity. He ruled that out also. He said, "You can't run away from problems. You've got to stay and face the problems." And that's when the third response dawned on him, the response of non-violent action. From that point onwards, he developed a philosophy of non-violence and practiced it in his life as well as in his search for justice in South Africa. He ended up staying in that country for 22 years. And then he went and led the movement of India. What you've just listened was written by Stephen R. Covey from the book The Eighth Habit.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at a story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So when we look at this, I find it funny that anyone would imagine Islam advocates in any way violence and hostility and aggression. And those who so-called quote-unquote Muslims that cannot even be considered as Muslims, who go around and execute aggression and violence in the name of Islam and in the name of the Prophet and Mercy, not only are incredibly stupid, but they have very little and poor understanding of the religion of Allah. And they commit massacres and genocides and mass murders based on less than 10 verses in the Quran that tells the Muslim to defend themselves against oppression, against usurp, against aggression, against those who threaten their safety, their security, and their prerogative to practice their religion. There are practically less than 10 verses in the Quran that directly talk about jihad, defensive jihad, which is really the only form of jihad that exists within the religion. And they tarnish the entirety of Islam. They disgrace Muslims. They ruin the reputation and the name of the Prophet and Mercy across the entire globe based on these handful of verses, while the rest of the Quran and all of the other teachings of Islam talk about peace, talk about tolerance, talk about not retaliating badness and aggression in the same way and form. Idfa billati hiya ahsan. The same Quran that tells us to pick up a sword and fight for our rights when we're oppressed and we're driven out of our homelands tells us that when the time calls for it, idfa billati hiya ahsan. Retaliate in the best manner, with softness, with compassion, with understanding, with forgiveness. That has been the method of the Ahlul Bayt and Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So don't come telling me that Islam advocates murder. Islam advocates taking the lives of innocent people and civilians, albeit against our religion, albeit disbelievers. Anyone who says that, I'm going to be straight up forward, isn't a Muslim, because they haven't understood not just the essence, but even the apparent message of a religion which is synonymous with peace. That's all the time we have for today's episode of the show. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.